Call the meeting to order, the State Government Finance Division.
We'll take the roll visually. Looks like we have a
quorum. Representative Pookie moves approval of the minutes of January 16th. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Okay, we're looking today at two things. The presentation from the legislative auditor on the presentation of the state grants to non-profits. And then we're going to have, and then after that, we're going to have some information on the public pension process, at least in the state. Okay, Ms. Randall, please, and Mr. Noble.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. Apparently, we don't quite have a computer set up for making our PowerPoint presentation. So while we continue to work on that, I will give you just a very brief introduction to this report.
We don't seem to have the report handed out to members, so we're going to do that too. Well, we'll get our act in order one of these days.
Well, Madam Chair, as I think the members know, the Office of the Legislative Auditor is the auditor of state government, and we audit a lot of things. But on a regular basis, we do not audit grants to nonprofit organizations. But periodically, over the last several years, we've received allegations about inappropriate use of grant money. And so on an ad hoc basis, we have done several investigations. And when we've done those, we found things that were disturbing: the misuse of state money, and also some issues about the management and internal controls and financial controls within nonprofits. So it's an issue we continue to come back to, and this time we asked the Legislative Audit Commission to authorize a broader scale evaluation so that we could look on our side of the issue, state government's side, because frankly, we don't think we can just audit or investigate or evaluate our way to good government. We can certainly uncover problems and make recommendations, but to really get good government, we've got to go to the source. And oftentimes the source is right here, in state government. And so we have to get off on the right foot when we're giving taxpayer money to nonprofits. And that's what this report is all about: strengthening accountability to ensure that the hundreds of millions of dollars that are spent by state government in grant money to nonprofits is used effectively and managed effectively. To just illustrate a little bit how compelling this issue, I think, can be to all of us in this room, legislators, staff, and citizens, let's think for a minute that there's $100,000 in this envelope, and it was money that was appropriated by the legislature, so it's taxpayer money, and I just happened to stop by the Treasury and take it out, and by the law, it's going to go to the Department of Human Services to facilitate families adopting children with special needs. And the Department of Human Services has decided that the best way to use this $100,000 is to grant it to a nonprofit organization. So I would ask you, what policies and procedures would you expect the Department of Human Services to follow in deciding who would get this $100,000? Should it be just an organization they know or they have some affiliation or connection with? We don't think so. We think there should be an open, competitive process. There should be a notice that the state has this need. There should be competition before there is a decision. We also think there should be a contract between the state and the nonprofit organization about what is expected, timelines, performance standards. And there should be some follow-up by the agency to determine that there is good performance. So those are some of the best practices that we laid out as our expectations for how the Department of Human Services would grant this $100,000 or the $300 million that in fact goes out every year from state agencies. And then we went and looked to see how well these best practices are put in place by state agencies. And we found a fairly mixed picture. We found some good practices, but we found some that fell far short. And so we make a number of recommendations to strengthen accountability, to ensure that when grants are made, that the public gets its due. Judy Randall was the manager of our evaluation, and I'm going to turn the microphone over to her, although it appears that we don't yet have conductivity for our presentation, but I think she can proceed anyway.
Randall. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Judy Randall, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm pleased to be here today to talk about our findings and recommendations from our evaluation on state grants to nonprofit organizations. If you all have the handout, we'll just go along with that until we get this thing up and running. Our overall conclusion is that state grants should be more consistently and efficiently managed. Specifically, we found that agency grant management practices and policies were inconsistent and inadequate. We found that there are limited... Yeah, don't look at that yet. I'll tell you when to look at it. Don't look at the screen yet.
Okay,
here we go.
Thank you.
All right. Now you can look at the screen. Okay.
Hold on. Yeah, hold on.
I love technology. Okay, I think now we're good. So our overall conclusion is that state grants should be more consistently and effectively managed, as I said, and specifically we found agency grant policies and practices were inconsistent and inadequate. We found limited executive branch grant policies that apply to all state agencies, and those that do exist are not enforced. And we found especially weak oversight of legislatively mandated grants. Now let me just take a second and say, why are we focusing on grants to nonprofit organizations? I know Mr. Noble talked a little bit about this. Well, first of all, there are a lot of nonprofit organizations in the state. We estimated that there are over 31,000 nonprofit organizations in Minnesota, and they receive a lot of money. In 2005, state agencies across all agencies awarded about $300 million through grants to nonprofit organizations. And, as you're aware, our office has conducted several investigations of grants to nonprofit organizations over the past several years and found some inappropriate use of state grant funds and some inadequate oversight by state agencies. Now, let me talk a moment about what I mean by the term grant. When the state makes purchases for its own use, it does so through professional technical contracts, service contracts, and purchase orders. State agencies use these mechanisms to purchase things like software and architectural designs, or snow plowing services, or ballpoint pens and notepads. When the state makes purchases for other people, for citizens and communities, it does so through grants. So the critical distinction of a grant is that the state is not actually getting something with a grant. It's paying for somebody else, for a citizen or a community, to get something. So when we set out to do this evaluation, we set up some evaluation criteria. And in the report, we refer to them as our grant management best practices. We developed these best practices from a variety of different sources, including the Department of Administration's contract manual, the national literature, previous reports and findings and recommendations that our office has issued, and also the grant management practices from some local foundations, like the McKnight Foundation and the Bush Foundation. On page 23 of the report, table 3.1 lists all of the best practices that we put forward. Today I'm going to just talk about four of them. The first is regarding the award process. The best practices suggest that grants should be awarded through a competitive and open process. Best practices also say that there should be a written grant contract for all grants that are awarded, that grant managers should conduct a formal site visit of all grantees at least once during a grant period, and finally, that grant managers should review a sample of grantee expenditures and reconcile them with supporting documentation. Now, when we applied these best practices, our evaluation criteria, to the grants that we reviewed, we found that agency grant practices were inconsistent and at times inadequate. We reviewed 50 grants from six agencies, the Departments of Human Services, Public Safety, Education, Health, Natural Resources, and HEAT, Department of Employment and Economic Development. We found that grant management practices varied across the agencies and also within the agencies. So, for example, I spoke to one grant manager in one division of DHS who said that they routinely verified grantee expenditures and reviewed them. I spoke to another grant manager in another division of DHS who said that they never reviewed grantee expenditures or did a formal financial reconciliation. Now, not only were the grant management practices inconsistent, at times we found that they were inadequate, and I'm going to spend a little bit more time today talking about that. All right, so the first best practice I talked about was regarding the award process. And grants should be awarded through an open and fair competitive process. So the grant opportunity should be advertised broadly. Interested organizations can apply for the opportunity. An application review committee would review the applications and then select the most qualified grantees. Well, in our review, only 19 of the 50 grants were competitively awarded through that type of process. Most of the remaining grants were awarded either as continuation grants to existing grantees or to legislatively mandated grantees. Two of the grants that we reviewed were awarded as sole source grants. And a sole source is when there's only one organization that's reasonably capable of providing the services. For one of these sole source grants, we agreed that it was a sole source. However, the other one was awarded by the Department of Natural Resources to build a fish barrier in Lake Moriah. And in fact, there were other organizations that could have provided that service. So we think that grant, for example, should have been awarded through a competitive process and not as a sole source. The next best practice states that grant contracts should be written. That seems kind of like a no-brainer. In addition to outlining the services that the grantee would be providing, it would outline the payment terms and also includes the standard contract clauses that the state has, things like data liability or data privacy and liability and ownership of equipment. Now, most of the grants that we reviewed did have a written grant contract that included these types of clauses. However, there were two grants, both in the Department of Education, that did not have a written grant contract. For one of these grants, department staff issued an award letter to the grantee stating the amount of the grant, but it did not outline the services to be provided or include any of those standard contract clauses. For the other grant, there was a letter of assurance that outlined some of the services to be provided, but again, those standard contract clauses were not there, and those contract clauses provide some protection for the state. The next best practice is regarding site visits. And best practices say that grant managers should conduct a formal site visit of all grantees at least once during a grant period. The purpose would be to observe the grantee's activities and ensure that the services agreed upon through the grant are actually being provided. For 26 of the grants we reviewed, so for over half of the grants we reviewed, there was no formal site visit being conducted. This is in contrast to those grants where there were formal site visits being conducted, where grant managers had extensive checklists and monitoring protocols, and they were really checking up and making sure that the services agreed upon in the grant were being provided. The last best practice I'm going to talk about today is regarding the grantee's expenditures. Best practices suggest that grant managers should review a sample of grantee's expenditures and compare them with supporting documentation to ensure that it's an appropriate expenditure. What we're talking about here is, let's think of a grant manager submitting a payment request for $1,000 for services that they've provided in connection with a grant. Well, the grant manager should take a sample of the expenditures and review them and compare them to the supporting documentation, the receipts and timesheets and invoices, things that show exactly how that money was being spent, so that the grant manager can confirm that it was an appropriate grant expenditure and appropriate for state funds. We saw this type of financial reconciliation for only 10 of the grants that we reviewed. For the other grants that we reviewed, there was none of this verification that the grantee's expenditures were appropriate. Now, part of why we think that the agency's grant management practices were inadequate and inconsistent is because the grant policies are inconsistent and at times inadequate. We reviewed the grant policies from the six agencies included in our evaluation, and we found that they really varied quite widely. The Department of Natural Resources, for example, does not have a written agency-wide grant management policy. Different divisions within the department might have a written grant policy, but there was no comprehensive agency-wide policy. So, for example, DNR does not have a policy that requires all grants to be awarded through a competitive process. Now, the other agencies that we reviewed did have detailed grant policies. Some of them, the Departments of Human Services, Public Safety, and Education had really quite detailed grant policies, but even those policies we found to be inadequate. For example, the policies did not require grant managers to conduct site visits, nor did it require grant managers to conduct the financial reconciliation and verification of grantees' expenditures. Now, contributing to the agency, the problems we found with the agency policies and practices is that there are limited executive branch grant policies that apply to all state agencies, and those that do exist are not enforced. The Department of Administration has a contract manual that provides guidelines and requirements on how agency staff interact with outside vendors. One chapter of the manual is devoted to grants and provides grant guidelines. However, guidelines are not enforced. While they're kind of out there as a reference more than anything else. This is in pretty stark contrast to the way the state handles professional technical contracts. There are several chapters in the contract manual that are devoted to PT contracts, and as you may know, Department of Administration staff must approve most PT contracts before they can go into effect. Now, in the beginning of the presentation, I said the state spent about $300 million in 2005 on grants to nonprofit organizations. Well, in the same year, the state spent about $350 million on all PT contracts. But the state has much tighter control and much more consistent oversight of the PT contracts than it does of the grants. Now, in addition to the problems we found in general with grant management, we found especially weak oversight of legislatively mandated grants. And a legislatively mandated grant is when a grantee is named specifically in law or described in such a way that really only a few organizations qualify. For example, the law might say, grant $100,000 to LifeWork Services Incorporated to provide XYZ services. Or it might say, grant $100,000 to a council in Duluth that provides compulsive gambling services. Well, in fact, there's only one or two organizations that meet that criteria. In essence, these organizations are guaranteed the grant funds, and so there's no competition for these funds. There's weaker oversight and accountability of these grants. Some of the agency staff we spoke with said that they felt they had limited authority to require legislatively mandated grantees to comply with their monitoring requirements because these organizations were guaranteed the funds no matter what. And in fact, in our site review, we found that grant managers were less likely to conduct site visits or require progress reports from these grantees. Done kind of quickly, let me give you a quick recap of our key findings just to remind you. So we found that agency grant practices and policies are inconsistent and inadequate. There are limited executive branch grant policies that apply to all state agencies, and those that do exist are not enforced. We found especially weak oversight and accountability of the legislatively mandated grantees. So our recommendations are really geared at improving accountability and efficiency. Our primary recommendation is that the state should establish the Grants Management Office. The office would be responsible for developing best practices, creating a standard grant contract that all agencies would be expected to use when entering into a grant, require that grant managers verify a sample of grantee expenditures and ensure that they're appropriate, and in general, ensure compliance with the grant policy. Now, the office would be responsible for ensuring that grant managers are complying with the best practices and the state's grant management practices, also ensuring that grantees are able to comply and help them comply with the state's grant management policies. A couple of additional notes about this office. The Grants Management Initiative of Governor Pawlenty's Drive to Excellence also recommended creating a Grants Management Office pretty similar to this one. And in fact, many of our findings and recommendations parallel the work done by the Drive to Excellence. The state is already pretty far along in some of these points. I mean, if you look at the first point, developing best practices, well, page 23 of our report already kind of gives them a big jump start on doing that. Similarly, there's a standard grant contract template that the Department of Administration has created that could be used as a starting off point. We don't envision this office as a big office. We think 2 to 3 people could fulfill the responsibilities that we envision for it. And the point is not to add another layer of bureaucracy and bureaucratic hoops for state agencies to have to jump through. But grants are managed by the program staff with the program expertise in the agencies, so they don't necessarily have the grant management expertise. And that's where this office would come in. Our other main recommendation is to eliminate legislatively mandated grants. As I mentioned in the beginning, one of the best practices is to award grants through a competitive and open process. And legislatively mandated grants are essentially guaranteed the grant funds. Instead, we think that the legislature should allow agencies to award these grants through a competitive process to ensure both that the most qualified organization receives the grant and also to ensure the appropriate accountability. With that, I'll end the formal part of the presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Yes, we're going. Let me just ask a question right away for the elimination of legislatively mandated grants. You could mandate a grant to an agency and then tell them to go through these practices. You wouldn't call that a legislatively mandated. You could mandate grants to help with homeless people or something and then to the agency and not pick out the... The problem with the legislatively mandated grants was where they had picked out the agency to get it, or was it also a problem where they had given it to the... given a broad discretion to the agency and then and people still felt that that was somehow sacrosanct?
Madam Chair, members, the problem is when the legislature specifically names the recipient.
Okay.
So I think if the legislature said, you know, DHS, here's a grant for the service, go out and find somebody, that's great.
Okay.
That was easy enough.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about what percentage of the grants that were provided in 2005 were misused, where the money you don't think was spent appropriately or where there was misconduct.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. We did not look at kind of the end result of the grant in terms of how the money was actually used. We were looking more at how the state agency staff manage that process and to what extent would they be able to answer that question. And that's where we found the problems with the monitoring and the review of expenditures. And I think the fact that really we don't know the answer to that is kind of part of the problem.
Just a follow-up. It looks like the largest grants were to agencies that do human services for developmentally disabled adults. And to me that seems like a proper use of the granting program because we've sort of deinstitutionalized that, and presumably we're doing it this way because it's more efficient than having governments do it directly. And so I guess my concern with the recommendation that we have a grants administration office is that I believe the commissioner of each agency should be responsible for spending that agency's dollars appropriately, and so maybe in lieu of creating a different bureaucracy somewhere else, that each commissioner would be responsible for certifying that the grants administered by their agency follow this process.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Representative, I think that's kind of the current process. I mean, right now it really has been left to each agency because there isn't a uniform thing, and we've seen problems. We've seen that things aren't being done. Well, we haven't seen the end result, although our office has done, you know, some investigations over the past years that have found some problems. Things are done differently. I think that's what we've found, is that when it's left to each agency, it's not getting done, in our eyes, adequately.
Madam Chair, if I could just amplify, because I want to make sure everybody understands that we're not recommending that there be one office that decides who gets the grant, how the grant should be used. This is all about business practice or good government practice. This is about somebody that ensures that there is a contract, for example, that contract has certain provisions in it that protects the state, that requires performance. This is not about changing the judgment, which should reside within the programs in each department and agency about how they're going to spend the money and who ultimately is going to receive the grant. We do believe and support that that is where the expertise is. That's where it should remain. As Ms. Randall said, we envision here a very small office to simply help with the business aspects of the grant management process. And I would just, on your other question, and I think Ms. Randall covered this quite adequately, but I would just like to amplify what I said in my introduction, and that is we, in the Office of the Legislative Auditor, do not on a regular basis audit nonprofit grants or grants to nonprofit organizations. We expect that the agencies will provide that oversight. But there have been a number of instances where allegations have come to us, and we did not feel that there was adequate agency response, and we have conducted investigations, and we have found some quite inappropriate activities and real misuse of state grant funds, taxpayer money. So we believe it is out there. It happens. We don't mean by any means to suggest that there is rampant mismanagement in the nonprofit sector, but I can only speak from what we've found. And when we've looked and when we've investigated, we have found significant problems.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Randall. I'm just wondering if establishing a grant management office, can you speak to perhaps the cost effectiveness, cost savings of such an office versus not having such an office?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Well, we envisioned that there would be 2 to 3 people in the office, and that pretty quickly, once the best practices get established and things are more efficient, that would be cost neutral, just the bottom line, because there would be pieces of grant managers in different agencies that then wouldn't have to be concerned with developing the best practices and ensuring compliance.
Thank you.
You know, one of the... President Sellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Randall or Mr. Nobles, there are federal and state laws that govern how you classify as a nonprofit that they already need to follow. I'm wondering if in some of these audits and some of your research you found were some of these nonprofits not only breaking, skirting, flirting with the rules on that status as well as how they're spending their money, because I would assume, and maybe I'm wrong, I'm not up on nonprofit rules, but aren't there some reporting, because with you, I agree it's a really dangerous game when there's nobody looking at the spreadsheets, the invoices, you know, just the receipts. Who are you paying and how much are you paying to? So I'm wondering if there's any rules that they are breaking already to even be granted that nonprofit standard.
Madam Chair, Representative, we didn't look at that directly, and we didn't see any evidence of people who of organizations that were claiming to be nonprofits who weren't. But again, we didn't look at that issue. We do have a part of the report in the beginning that kind of talks about nonprofits and for-profits and what makes them different. But we didn't really look at your question.
Although, Madam Chair, again, I would refer back, and it is a very limited subset of nonprofits, and again, I emphasize we don't mean to use this as a means of generalizing, but again, I think relevant to your question, we have found certainly weak financial controls in some nonprofits where, for example, executive directors were able to grant themselves salary increases without board approval, use funds inappropriately for private functions, to furnish home offices, to pay for meals and other expenses that certainly appear to us to be more of a private nature than related either to the public aspect of the nonprofit or the grant itself. So, and we did find in one instance where money had been used to make a political contribution, which would be a violation. But that was
a Republican or a Democrat.
Madam Chair, being a nonpartisan organization, we did not ask.
Madam Chair and Mr. Nobles, Ms. Randall, my next question was the salaries, the hiring practices, if there were any. You know, if they're not reporting where they're spending their money on or who they're giving it to, I'm imagining some of that stuff. And maybe that was part to the question of the rules governing a nonprofit, who is getting paid and how much. And then the one thing I did not notice in many recommendations that I'm not sure if you considered a fine or you know, some teeth to go with just the office, but if we're we're finding these errors, you know, slapping somebody on the hand and saying, don't do it again is nice, but is it really incentive for them to shape up and act right and spend the money wisely?
Well, Madam Chair, members, we did not make that recommendation, but we're aware of the fact that the federal government uses a pretty heavy hand with people that receive those monies, taxpayers' monies, both under contracting and granting provisions of federal rules. Organizations can be and are debarred from receiving federal funds. We don't have that practice in Minnesota for grants, but it's something you could consider. consider.
And if I could just add one thing to that, Madam Chair, we do envision this office of having a compliance authority, kind of doing some of the work that our office has done in terms of being able to investigate noncompliance or problems. So having some teeth to the office.
And if I could just begin amplify, and getting money back. I mean, that's what we do. We cannot compel it, but when we find money has been inappropriately used, we seek civil recovery through the Attorney General and criminal prosecutions from county attorneys. And we achieve those kinds of actions on occasion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Nobles, I saw the one part of legislative grant making that I've been actively involved with for years and years was with LCMR. And I saw one line in it somewhere, and now I can't find it again. But I always thought that was a really, compared to most legislative activity, that was really pretty thorough oversight in terms of work projects. You know, I don't see any of these criticisms, except for the non-competitive nature. The competitive nature came in the grant-making process. But one of the things, you know, for example, one of the things that LCMR religiously adhered to, that it was something I had put into state law, which I think is universally ignored, is the need for a peer review process, the things that have scientific basis behind it. And I know that, you know, again, that was something that they adhered to. What did you look at with LCMR, and did you see any?
Madam Chair, we included the LCMR grants in our review, and they were pretty good, actually. I mean, they were competitively awarded, so although they are legislatively named, we talked about this, and they're kind of the exception to that recommendation, because they do go through a competitive process, and they have a lot of oversight. And those are our main concerns with the legislatively mandated grants, is that they're not competitively awarded, and they generally don't have as much oversight. And LCCMR is really an exception to what we saw.
Okay. Good.
And Madam Chair, we worked very closely with Mr. Boleyn and the LCCMR. And
any of the awarded grants that you were looking at only came from LCMR, I think.
That's correct, Madam Chair, but we have every expectation that the addition of citizens will give even more accountability and oversight.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What was I thinking about? Mr. Nolan, you said it started out, the first question is just on process. You said you looked at six agencies, and I don't know, I guess I should know that. What percentage of state agencies is that? Or maybe the chair would know that.
Of all state agencies, again, Madam Chair, Representative De La Forest, you know, we would get to some degree into a nomenclature issue. You know, actually, we have jurisdiction over all state entities, and we count about 160 to 170 different organizations within state government, within the executive branch of state government, that we have audit jurisdiction for.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Noble, so I guess it's fair to say, regardless of how it's defined, that you looked at only a small percentage of what we call state government.
That's true. However, I would just add that not all of those, because when I use that number, that includes things like the board of the Barber Board or any of the medical licensing boards. There are a lot of small commissions that don't have money to make grants with. Actually, we have a table which will show you that the largest share of grant money is concentrated in the Department of Human Services. So we actually did a somewhat selective sample, given the fact that grant money is not evenly distributed around all state agencies. It's quite concentrated.
Yeah. So just Madam Chair, to follow up with a comment, in looking at the summary findings page, Mr. Nobles, it says that at least in 2005, the state made $4.7 billion in payments to nonprofit organizations. And we're talking about a great deal of money here. And it seems to me, given the fiduciary obligation that the legislature has to the taxpayers, it would only be appropriate, I would think, that some type of moratorium be placed on the grant payments or the awarding of new grants until some type of uniform system is put in place. I mean, I'm hearing very troubling things from you today. Unfortunately, you're the bearer of bad news to bring good government. I know, having served in this committee, but it's troubling, especially when I hear that some agencies have no policies, others have weak policies. It really galls me, quite frankly, when you say that you have brought instances of clear malfeasance or nonfeasance to state agencies regarding grants they've awarded, and these agencies, for whatever reason, have apparently blown off these red flags that you have raised. So I'm not convinced that we are doing right by the taxpayers to continue to let grant money go out the door unless we are assured that some type of procedural safeguards are in place to assure the taxpayers that we're doing the right thing with their money.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative De La Forresta, I appreciate your concern. Frankly, this is an issue we have been putting forth for a number of years, and I appreciate very much the attention that it's receiving this year. And that's why we appreciate the opportunity to be here before this committee. But I also appreciate the fact that Governor Plenty has paid attention to this issue as well through the organization, the Drive to Excellence effort initiative that the governor put forth. And in fact, you may want to refer at the back of our report to a response that we received from Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, who is the lead a staff person for the governor in that aspect of the Drive to Excellence. And I think I'm fair in my paraphrasing that they're very much on board with the recommendations that we're making. They, more than anybody, I think, see what we saw because they see it from the inside as well, that there needs to be better accountability. As I think I said in my opening, I think we all who work in government see this as one of the soft spots in accountability, and it needs to be strengthened.
If you look, Chris, if you look at the list, you'll see that none of them went through the committee that you or I served on. So that's why attention wasn't paid to it earlier. They need to distribute the, you know, the nasty people all get put in one place, and the nice people with warm hearts get put in other places. And, you know, so this is our first attempt to find place of attention.
And a potential second career for us as auditors. My name would go first on
the list. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about, I know I had a nonprofit agency in my community that had applied for a grant, used the RFP to match the criteria of the grant application to the request for proposal, was not granted the grant, and when they sought more information about who received the grant and some of that, found out that the grant reviewers did not use the RFP criteria as the criteria for awarding the grant. And I'm just wondering if you addressed that in some of what you were looking at as far as actually taking the very beginning of what the intent is to... to take what the intent is of the grant dollars and every way through the process to make sure that the grant is done appropriately.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did look at the extent to which criteria were included in RFP, and there were a number of cases when the criteria to select the successful grantees was not published at all. And so we do address it in our best practices, saying that the criteria should be published and that the published criteria should be used. We weren't really in a position to judge whether the review committees made the correct choices. We could review applications, and we reviewed the RFPs, but in terms of if the criteria were applied appropriately, that was kind of outside of our scope.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm just wondering then, is that part of the process, though, that at least the RFP criteria must be the criteria used in awarding the grant? I mean, is that something that is indicated as a best practice in how you're determining this?
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, in the best practices table on page 23, under the grant announcement, it says the grant notice should clearly identify the grant expectations and selection criteria. I guess it was then implied that you would use the selection criteria, but, yeah.
And, Madam Chair, if I might just again amplify, because there's another related issue, I believe. You didn't quite touch on it, but it is related, and that is we think that there should be standards that would prevent any conflicts of interest among those who are reviewing the responses to the RFP. And that, frankly, it has occurred in some agencies that we've examined where there have been some affiliations that we thought constituted conflicts that should have been avoided.
Okay, we do have another half of the committee meeting. This is kind of a good introduction. I'm a big fan of the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we're a big fan of this committee.
Okay. And so there are lots of, there's a wonderful table of all kinds of things that members in their spare time can get copies of all of these evaluations. And if there's anything that somebody sees, even if it's been something in the past that they'd like to have a further hearing on, I'm open to suggestions as to how we do it. You know, again, I think this is one of the strongest arms of the legislature in terms of helping us get new information. But how they get treated by the legislature is kind of, problematical. Turns out it depends whether the individual legislator agrees with their conclusion or not. Depends on whether they like them or not. But any other comments? Okay. We're now going to start another issue, which, in fact, I will call attention to members of the committee. There are two legislative auditors' reports that are coming out on Monday, and the first legislative hearing that I know of these will be on Wednesday in the Government Operations Committee. So members who aren't members of that committee might be interested. Oh, Tuesday. Okay. And that's on pensions. But anyway, this is Mr. Martin from the staff person to the Legislative Commission on Pensions will be our first introduction to this topic. Martin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Larry Martin. I'm Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement.
I'm sorry. You know, I went a little bit too fast. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to make any comments on the last report? I'm sorry. I should have done that. Just very briefly.
Here. Thank you, Madam Chair. It will be brief, but I'm of course eager. Thank you.
Okay.
My name is Marcia Abner. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and I appreciate the opportunity to make very brief comments. And I feel compelled to do that today simply because there was so much press attention to this report when it was released. The Minnesota Council of Nonprofits has, as the legislative auditor indicated, I believe, been very supportive of this investigation into state grant-making practices. We feel that it's important to underscore that the purpose of this audit and the reason that it was selected as a priority for this year was not because of a litany of bad behavior on the part of nonprofits. Much to the contrary, nonprofits have asked for this reform for a period of time. I was able to serve on the Drive to Excellence task force. It was a year and a half long exhaustive process that I think really enabled the state to identify the needs for systematic, transparent, and accountable approaches. We will be working very closely with the Department of Administration. I believe you have heard from Commissioner Dana Badgero that she's interested in bringing legislation forward. We are supportive of the recommendations that this report has made, as well as of the DTE Drive to Excellence recommendations. And we want to be really clear that there are already in place remedies if nonprofits violate the trust in any way. But by and large, nonprofits are highly accountable and responsible. As many of you know, in Minnesota's philanthropic community, grants are made in the amount of over $800 million per year, under extremely rigorous and systematic circumstances. So nonprofits, which are highly regulated and accountable, have good patterns of behavior in engaging in grant agreements with their funders, whether that is state government, county or city government, or the private philanthropic sector. And so we wanted to clear for the record that we are very supportive of reforms in the state system. We think that the issues of conflict of interest, clarity about criteria, standardized posting so all rural suburban, small, large nonprofits have access to information is crucial. And we do want to keep the focus of this on what's really needed to make the system indeed a system in state government. Nonprofits want very much to be good partners in this, and we appreciate the opportunity to clarify that, because I think when the press first did this, as is often covered this, as is often the case, they were hoping for some scandalous activity on the part of nonprofits, and that was really not the focus of this report at all. Where there has been egregious behavior on rare occasions, there are remedies for addressing that, and I think those are reported in the legislative auditor's report. So we want to work with the committee, with the department, and with the Office of the Legislative Auditor to ensure that the system works and is transparent and has equal access statewide for nonprofits and other grantees. Thank you for the time.
Okay, thank you. And is there anyone else who would like to make any comments? Again, briefly, I'm sorry, I didn't really leave enough time.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Rich Calls. I'm the Executive Director of the Charities Review Council. We have been around for 60 years maintaining standards of accountability for nonprofits. We are thought of sometimes as a charity watchdog. I would like to just say that at this point, when you're considering setting up policies and consistent, systematized grant policies, that there are standards that exist that can be useful. And we have a new process that opens up our review process to all nonprofits operating in Minnesota. So I would encourage the use of that. And I would second what Marcia said, that we have this review relationship with nonprofits, and you read about the ones that are not accountable. Those are the true exceptions, and so I think some of the news coverage sort of played into that mythology a little bit.
Okay. I think people look forward to your help in dealing with this problem with legislation and otherwise. Oh, better oversight, too.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we can move on to Mr. Martin.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Pension Commission. I'd like to briefly talk to you about why pensions exist in Minnesota, perhaps, why they're on a topic of legislative concern, and what the Legislative Commission on Pensions does, and then from there handle questions as time permits. Government, because it's labor intensive, has lots of employees, and employees, part of the typical employment arrangement involves pensions. Pensions are a somewhat significant item in Minnesota government. There are close to 500,000 people who either are active members of Minnesota public pension plans or recipients of Minnesota public pension plan benefits. The Minnesota public pension plans are in statute. They're actually a topic of legislation. The governance or the review and the decision making in the main on Minnesota public pension plans is lodged in the Minnesota legislature. The Minnesota legislature also has created over the years several aid programs that help local government defray the costs of public employee pensions. And those are also a topic of appropriation concern. This committee once had essentially all of the pension-related aid programs within its jurisdiction. It now shares the jurisdiction with the tax committee. Some of the aid programs are with the tax committee, and some are still with this committee, and we can talk briefly about those. Historically, Minnesota public pension plans were created between the two world wars, or right around the two world wars in the 20th century. Most of our public employee pension plans were created by 1930 or thereabouts. All of the major plans were created by then. The three largest statewide plans, the teachers plan in 1915, the state retirement system in 1929, and the public employees plan in 1931. So our plans were largely put in place to some extent prior to any consistent legislative oversight or consistent legislative monitoring of public employee pensions. Minnesota has a large number of public employee pension plans. There are an estimated 9,000 public employee pension plans in the entire country, and we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 750 or 800 of those plans. So we're approaching the 8 or 10% of all the plans in the country. That number is potentially misleading in the sense that most of our public employee pension plans are volunteer fire pension programs. Pension programs that are more of a longevity award rather than an actual life-sustaining source of income for retirees. They're a reward for long service, long volunteerism by 15 or 20,000 volunteer firefighters in the state. The Pension Commission was first created as an interim commission, first during the 1940s and then more consistently during the 1950s, and became a permanent commission in 1967 and has continued thereafter. I have a handout in your packets. There's some basic information on the Pension Commission in the early pages of the documents. Commission is made up of 5 members of the House and 5 members of the Senate. The current commission, or the 2007-2008 commission, has not yet been appointed by either the House or the Senate. The commission functions very much as a joint subcommittee on pensions. It's a bicameral entity. It processes all legislation, utilizes basically conference committee rules, so there have to be 3 House members at least and 3 Senate members in support of any piece of legislation before it's recommended by the Pension Commission. Representative Kahn takes credit, and probably correctly so, for the current process of aggregating pension bills into a single or a small number of omnibus pension bills. And to the extent that those pension bills have any state fiscal impact, typically they would come before your division. And during a budget year, that would be the expected circumstance. The commission typically handles somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 or 80 pension bills during any given session, and a fair number of those are recommended by the Pension Commission and ultimately are reduced to one or more omnibus pension bills. In your packets, the Commission on Pensions does have a statement or a set of principles of pension policy. If you turn to page 5, there's the start of that document. It's a bit of a motherhood and apple pie document in some sense, that it does speak in generalities, but it is the basis for the Pension Commission staff reviewing pension legislation and raising policy issues with respect to pension legislation. Madam Chair, I can get into more topical items about public pensions if you'd like, or did you want to just talk about the agency and its scope and functioning?
So let's see if you have some questions and then just proceed. I'm confident to go in the direction you want to, but are there any questions on the general? Okay, just keep going.
Madam Chair, if I could have you turn to page 29 of the document. this will give you a sense, perhaps, of numbers and what shape Minnesota public pension plans are in. We've taken the roughly 750 or 800 pension plans in the state of Minnesota and have presented you with some totals aggregating plans together by type. the statewide general employee plans are the three major pension funds. They cover the bulk of Minnesota public employees, the statewide teachers plan, the statewide public employees plan, and the state employees pension plan. What you're seeing here, to make sense out of this set of numbers, you have a basic information on membership at the top of the of each column. Then what's called funded status. This is a comparison of the current assets of the pension plan with the liabilities as calculated by the actuary retained to make those calculations. And then if there is an unfunded pension liability, there's the indication of that unfunded amount and a funding ratio. And you'll hear people in the pension world talk about funding ratios. They're talking about defined benefit plans. This is the functional equivalent to the equity that you have in your house. How much value versus how much is your mortgage? On the remaining balance on your mortgage. The next set of items are covered payroll. This is the cumulative or the total salaries of all of the individuals covered by the public pension plan or plans in this category. The benefits payable is the current annual payout of the pension plan to all the individuals who are in benefit status. Then there are some cost items. Normal cost is the first item, and this is the value of the pension plan to active members. If you were to start the plan today, if you had no unfunded pension liability and you were covering this group of people, this is the percentage of covered pay or the dollar amount that would have to be put into the plan to cover the benefits that are being earned by all the individuals in the plan for this coming year. So this is the value of the benefit coverage to active members on an average basis. The administrative expense is what it costs to run the plan, and we keep track of the normal costs and expenses because the broad commission policy is that member contributions should pay roughly one half of the normal costs and expenses at a minimum. Running down, there is also something called the amortization contribution. This is the debt service on that unfunded pension liability that is indicated up above, the unfunded accrued liability figure. And then it's all totaled up in total requirements. Then the contribution streams that are coming into the pension plan, the member contributions, employer contributions, and if there are aid programs, then the total contributions as a gross total, and then on the bottom line, a comparison of what the actuary says is needed in total versus what is actually coming into the plan in total. Plans are in good shape at a minimum if there is no deficiency in their contributions, just like your financial circumstances are in good shape if you can pay the bank mortgage every month. So the requirements should be covered. Whether a plan is well-funded or not well-funded is of less importance if the annual support that's committed to that pension plan is sufficient. So there are sometimes suggestions that a plan should be X percent funded, 50% funded, 75% funded, 90% funded. It's always, of course, better to be 100% funded because that means you don't have any debt service. But if the funding stream that's going into the plan is sufficient, a plan could be relatively poorly funded and still be in good shape, either because the funding for the plan was implemented late or for a variety of reasons. The judge's plan comes to mind as a plan where the current judge's plan was only set up in 1973. Full actuarial funding was only first provided for the judge's pension coverage back in 1973. And concurrent state contributions, regular state contributions, really only provided for about 1990. So this plan has only been put on a good funding stream for a relatively short period of time. It is not particularly well funded, about 75%, but a significant contribution stream has been committed to the plan, and in the main, it's getting it will be fully funded.
Mr. Martin,
in appropriate time.
Explain on page 29 on the last line. Could you explain the surplus on the bottom for the total local police and paid fire plans, and also for the volunteer fire plans? Why both of those show surpluses?
Madam Chair, this for the volunteer fire, it's perhaps easier to explain than for the local paid fire and police plans. The volunteer fire plans, there are some close to 700 volunteer fire plans. Some of these plans are very well-funded plans. Some are not very well-funded plans. Some jurisdictions provide a municipal contribution, even if there is not an actuarial requirement for that contribution. There's an agreed-upon arrangement locally in that given jurisdiction to make a certain contribution to the volunteer firefighters, irrespective of the actuarial work. So when you add up all these together, since state law does require them to be putting in at least what's needed actuarially each year, and then you have some jurisdictions providing more than that, you get the phenomenon of having more funding coming in than is actually needed in that given year. In some cases, also, given the way we regulate volunteer fire plans, volunteer fire are subject to certain minimum standards and certain maximum benefit practices. They set their own local benefits locally, subject to this regulation, which looks to the prior funding history of the plan in order to gauge how much they can promise for the future. That induces volunteer fire plans and their government units to make some premature or in anticipation contributions to the volunteer fire plan to build this funding stream up so that they can grant a better pension benefit to that group of firefighters. That also contributes to some overfunding at any given point in time. With the police and paid fire, this probably is, well, these numbers, there's a very small number of plans in this grouping. Bloomington Fire, Minneapolis Police and Fire, Fairmont Police, and Virginia Fire are the plans in that category. And the funding surplus, the additional contributions here are probably something to do with Bloomington Fire having a very large swing in their investments recently and still getting state aid. There's a large amount of fire state aid that goes to the Bloomington Fire. And also there are some blinking on and off of Minneapolis Fire city contributions depending upon the funding situation in the plan. And so there can be anomalies in those numbers. And I think that's what you're seeing here. There is a specific table for the local police and paid fire on page 34. And you can get a sense of this contribution stream differential. Look at Bloomington Fire, and in this case, Minneapolis Police, having some contribution surpluses or sufficiencies.
Okay. Representative Spigen?
Madam Chair, if I could, Larry, kind of following through on Representative Hahn's question. If I read that page correctly, and tell me where my thought process is wrong, if I take out the local plans, the sufficiency that you show there in those two local plans, those two columns, you look at the statewide plans or the cities in the first class, would it be fair to say that we have about a $230 million deficiency?
Representative Swigman, yes.
To try to address the entire difficulty we face in pensions, is there not also a deficiency in the post-retirement plan?
Yes.
If you were going to fairly apportion or appropriate, and I'm not sure what the right word is, the post-retirement plan deficiency to also the plans you have here, what would the total deficiency be that we're looking at? And how big of a problem is it? Is it something I need to worry about today, tomorrow? When does it blow up? Give me a relative burden of excitement that you have.
I think a lot more information will be out on Monday.
On Monday?
Yeah.
Why Monday?
Monday, because that's when the legislative auditor puts out its reports on the retirement plans and the post.
I didn't know that, Madam Chair. I didn't realize that. My question is not answerable now, then?
It's not unanswerable. There are some computations that would need to be made that I can't do in my head. What Representative Swigham is referring to is
deficiency in the post-retirement
that I can give you
not shown here.
Yes, that is true.
So that would be in addition to the deficiency we see here.
Yes, and that's about a $4 billion number.
$4 billion?
Yes. So if you were to treat that as an unfunded pension liability, it would be an additional $4 billion on top of the current 7.4 that you see in the far right hand column. The number I can't give you is what the funding stream that would represent on an annual contribution basis.
Is it fair or Madam Chair? Is it fair or unfair, me of Larry, to consider that $4 billion deficiency in the post-retirement plan to be part of this deficiency, adding to the number of 7?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it would be unfair with an asterisk or fair with an asterisk, depending on how you want to explain it. It is a debt, potentially, of the pension plan. It could be an employer debt. It could be a contribution stream that the state at some point in the future would have to bear. Just as if we were to consistently not achieve investment returns equal to the current interest rate assumption, that they could eventually produce a need for additional contribution streams. The post-retirement fund that we're referring to is the mechanism for providing benefit increases to retirees in the statewide plans. And that provides both inflationary-related increases capped at 2.5% and investment performance-related increases whenever the post fund, the accumulated assets for retirees, exceed the investment income on the post fund exceeds 8.5%. During the 90s and right up into about 2001, the post fund produced very large post-retirement adjustments for retirees, and then the bottom fell out of the market in 2001-2002, anywhere from 25% to 40% decline in value in essentially 1 year. There is no mechanism for recouping immediately there's no reduction in an investment in related increase granted to a retiree whenever the market goes south. What there is no future investment related increases payable until that deficit is paid off. So there's a claim built into the system against any future investment income in the post fund above 8.5% to retire that unfunded, that deficit in the post fund. That's why I say with an asterisk, because it's not a debt that is necessarily going to be borne by the state, by the plan sponsors. It has a funding mechanism built into it. It is just at an indeterminate point in time because it depends upon investment gains.
Depends upon the markets.
Depends upon the markets. Mm-hmm. So, but it is a topic of concern. If you turn to page 63 of the document, I do give you some, a boiled down quick version of this post fund deficit issue and give you some indication of the numbers, at least of the total deficit. The brief background tries to explain in a few sentences how we do post-retirement increases for the statewide plans and how the investment-related increases work and what happened. And then in the middle of the page, there's the $4.2 billion figure, which is the entire post fund. And I've broken it out into the three biggest plans, the portion that's related to the state retirement system, PERA, and TRA. When the legislative auditor makes their report next week, going to focus on the post fund and the funding difficulty of the post fund, in part they have an accounting problem. General accepted accounting principles don't permit or don't approve of the way that we value the post fund within our annual financial reports. And so they're starting to make annotations or comments in the audit work on the major pension funds because of that. And that's one issue. Do we clean up on the accounting, the manner of handling the post fund and the pension fund accounting? Then beyond that, there's the funding issue of who owes the $4.2 billion. And right now it is a claim against any potential future increases for retirees for up to a couple of decades if the market is somewhat in a holding pattern as it seems to have been in the last couple of years and not huge gains. It could take upwards of two decades to recoup that $4.2 billion. And then beyond that, the benefit issue, the post fund, as we currently do things, is not a particularly straightforward way to solve a problem. It was created in 1969 as a way to do things on the cheap, as it were. When money fell from heaven, we would give away the money to the retirees. And now it's become a system where when money doesn't fall from heaven and the retirees do expect to get increases, there's a potential problem. When we had good investment performance, we were giving away increases that were 2, 3, 4 times the rate of inflation. So it was not well spread out either. So it overcompensated some group of our retirees and presumably will undercompensate some others. So there's a benefit issue, too, about what's the best way to do post-retirement increases, because the current mechanism doesn't seem to work well. That was a topic that was assigned to the Pension Commission for review during the course of the 2006-2007 interim. And that topic remains to be concluded by the Commission. The staff work has been done, and it's been presented to the Commission. The Commission is still mulling what to recommend. So that's the current status of that topic.
I'm not sure what the order will continue.
Just, Madam Chair, yeah. Just a real quick follow-up question. And Madam Chair, thank you for your patience. I like many of you, I tell my friends who are in the pension community, I know just enough about pensions to be helpful and just enough to be dangerous. And many of them see it both ways. Could I make a comment about your second, on page 63, Larry, where you have number 2, the post-retirement fund deficit? The first line, because the post-retirement fund increases are not rolled back and the investment climate is bad, and you referred to the 97, 98, 99, where we're getting 11, 12%, 10% increases, much more than people ever got when they were working, you know, my friends, your friends. And I heard all the stories, you know, they never got such big increases when they were working as they did when they retired. I thought we had made changes. I take difference with the line are not rolled back, because I thought we'd made changes in the last couple of 3 years to smooth out those post-retirement fund increases, had we not? So that there were not the large 10 or 11, 12% increases, that people would be more assured the 5% or cost of living increase. Didn't we make changes in pension laws to smooth that out?
Madam Chair, Representative Swigum, yes, last session there was a 5% cap placed on the total post-retirement increase payable from the post fund. That would be both the inflation component, which is currently capped at 2.5%, and the investment portion, which has no cap up until last year.
So in effect...
But that piece of legislation does not go into effect until 2010.
Oh, it doesn't?
No. In part because the argument is that because we do function in a world that's regulated to some degree by the federal government, and there is a need for a private letter ruling or some other contact from the Internal Revenue Service on whether that's permitted under current IRS regs to do it the way we're proposing to do it.
Some
lead time was
put in place. The 2010 date or the federal rule. I would have said that in effect, that bill that passed was a rolling back, at least from previous history. The way we treated the
representative, when rollbacks are usually used, that means that a retiree who is getting past increases would lose some of those past increases. It would actually be a reduction in some members' benefits, and
I thought that was illegal. I thought that was never done. You ever took anything away from someone that had been previously?
Well, historically, we never have, but. The first version of the post fund, when it was more of a variable annuity with a floor, that you could lose past increases in times of bad investment markets. So the 1969 through 1980 version of this post fund did provide for that. In 1980, that was done away with.
You're very knowledgeable. Thank you.
Jim, did you want to say anything on this?
Madam Chair, we will be releasing a report next Monday on volunteer firefighter pension funds, and we will also be releasing a report that will cover what is called other post-employment benefits for public employees, which mostly includes health care. But that report will also include a fairly substantial chapter on statewide pensions. And the issue that I think will be... discussed as a result of that report is the one that Mr. Martin just referred to, and that is the fact that we disagree with the current valuations of assets in the post-retirement fund. I feel able to discuss this even before we release that report to some degree because we just this week revised our audit opinion on the, it's called the CAFR, the Comprehensive Financial Report of the Public Retirement Pension Association, because we felt that readers of that report, including you as public officials, were not being adequately advised and alerted to the deficit that is in the post-retirement fund. And as we've gone around and briefed some of you about our concern, I think that's been substantiated, that you were not as fully aware of the deficit in the post fund as I think you should be. The reason is that the Pension Commission requires the actuary who does the funding ratios and the actuarial work for the statewide pension funds to value assets in the post-retirement fund equal to liabilities. Therefore, it is not a market-related valuation. That is not in compliance with generally accepted accounting principles. And therefore, we felt compelled to give an alert, a statement, a notice to you that it is not compliant and that it masks hides, if you will, a substantial deficit.
Mr. Noble, simple and direct words now. Does that mean your report on Monday is going to tell me that we are overvaluing the asset in the post-retirement fund and that the deficit is greater than the $4 billion? Is that what you're telling me? No.
Well, we're telling you that you are simply using an assertion now which has no relationship to the market. It is a simple assertion that whatever assets are there are equal to the liabilities. You assert that it's 100% funded, and that is not the reality. And so we think the first step in this process of dealing with what will be some very difficult policy issues is for you first to have the reality in front of you. It will not be an easy problem to solve, but we don't think you'll take steps down the road to solving it until you know there is a problem. And apparently, Representative Swigum, you were already aware from other communications, apparently, that there is a deficit there. And I think it has been talked about some more in recent days. But I think it needs to be talked about even more.
Well, to clarify, Mr. Nobles, is it just enough do I know it would be dangerous? Not real, I don't know a lot, but I
don't know. But Representative Swigum, I think you are aware, from whatever source, that there is a problem that needs to be addressed, and we agree.
Chris? Madam Chair, I actually had a question for you. I really appreciate you scheduling this hearing today. It's very informative, but now that you are chairing this committee, I was curious as to what your thoughts were regarding the division of jurisdiction, if you will, between this committee and the Pension Commission. How is this all going to break down? I mean, are we going to have the ability to influence pension legislation, or is pension work going to come to us for oversight? But how do you view our role in pension oversight?
Well, it always does. If there's a bill, you know, a pension bill can't just get passed by the Pension Commission. It gets passed, goes to the Government Operations Committee always, and then it's usually divided into these two bills, one without fiscal impact and one with fiscal impact. And the fiscal impact one has always come to this committee. And and obviously any member may propose an amendment at any time. Pension Commission besides being a great admirer of the legislative auditor, I'm also a great admirer of the Pension Commission staff. And you can get unbelievably detailed memos from them on any individual bill or on the total bill and so forth. I can give you lots of discussions that we've had up to on the floor of the House where I was, of course, invariably right, and the body invariably voted me down. One of those votes where you had a con crinky and 17 other people voting on what was the good public policy. And, it's difficult. The Pension Commission worked very, very hard and does good work, but it's really hard. You know, there are a lot of widows and orphans that come before it and cry, and it's really hard to say no a lot of the time. So, you know, we'll try. Again, I encourage members who are as interested in this issue, you know, to follow it up to the extent that they want to. But it's very difficult and really, really tough. So, but I'll repeat again the thing that I said at the first meeting. Is any issue that any member wants us to cut, you know, I can't promise that we'll always do it, but I certainly want to consider anything that any member wants to consider in greater detail and wants to have a better hearing on it and knows some people whom they want, you know, want to appear before us. So,
Madam Chair, question for you. Do you intend on having a hearing much like the one we just had on state grants to nonprofits on the report that will be coming out Monday?
Hearing those on the Thursday? Yes.
Okay.
At some point. I won't tell you what day it is. We have to
state.
But, as I said, GovOps will be hearing them on Tuesday morning. And so then,
okay.
You know, that's any member who wants to can get a heads up on looking at that. Martin, are there any other?
Madam Chair, just one item, if I can make a mention. Representative Swigum started the conversation. Unfortunately, he has left. But what you're seeing on page 29, as far as the funding, the comparison of the contribution levels and requirements, This is as of the 2006, June 30th, 2006 valuations. He was asking about the size of the shortfall in contributions, and this does somewhat overstate the size of the shortfall. I just wanted to add that in because there are some contribution increases that were approved by the 2005 and 2006 session of the legislature, which are phasing in over time. And this only picks up what is phased in to this date, as of June 30, 2006. And in some cases, there are phase-ins that go in as far as 2009 or 2010. So this does make this look a little bit worse from that standpoint, and I did want to add that. There is a later discussion in this document, if you're interested, on pages of 66 and 67 about the question of inadequate contribution rates, and that does try and give you some information with the phasings all taken into account. What happens? Are all of our plans in good shape? And there are a couple there are some that are not. Even with the phasings under the current set of actuactuarial costs, we still have some shortfalls. So that I included towards the end of the document are a number of potential policy issue areas or problem areas that you might be interested in, and trying to give you a brief one paragraph summary of the background that you need to get some sense of it, and then what are the policy issues, and just give you a flavor for some of the issues that you may see later in the session, things that would have financial impact or be of some financial significance.
Okay, I noticed. Is that 10 pages, 20 pages of problems?
Yes,
how many pages of problems and how many pages of solutions do you have in this report? That's a facetious question.
It only is 15 pages of problems.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? I noticed that there are a lot of people from the pension community in the audience. I think kind of at the end of our allotted time, I'm sure we'll be hearing from other people.
Yes, Madam Chair, the Pension Commission office is on this floor, right outside this office, actually. If you head out that exit door, you'll run right into my office virtually. So if you do have questions, if you have a constituent issue, we tend to do a certain amount of that sort of work. In going around door knocking, you ran into someone who has service credit that they didn't get from 1936. Come on into my office and we can identify the problem and see what the options are.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for this.